Finally, after 20 years, its annoyingly persistent rival. There was still, however, the small matter of the federal government, which had stipulated that Guthrie would be the state capital for at least another 3 years. But 3 years for Oklahoma City was eternity. The very night of the election, the governor of Oklahoma decided to heed the sacred will of the people. He left Guthrie immediately for OKC, where he set up downtown in the Huckins Hotel and wrote a formal decree on hotel stationery declaring that Oklahoma City was from that moment forward the official capital of the state. Meanwhile, his secretary headed back to Guthrie in secret to retrieve the state seal. The details of what happened that night are still in dispute. All we know is that it happened fast. Legend has it that the secretary climbed in through a window and smuggled the seal out in a basket of laundry. In any case, the coup was complete. The federal government surrendered. After 2 decades of trying, Oklahoma City had stolen the capital from Guthrie. It was, once again, at the very center of everything. Game 1. Those Who Sit Beside You. Every morning, in a small box at the bottom of its front page, the Oklahoman printed a prayer. On November 1, 2012, opening day of OKC's new NBA season, the prayer was short. "We give thanks for those who sit beside you," it read, "for they are holy and inspire us. Amen." Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook still sat beside one another, wearing uniforms that said Oklahoma City. James Harden, however, no longer sat between them. He was in Houston. 4 days after the trade, the Rockets had signed Harden to the most lavish contract the league would allow, $80 million over 5 years. His new team was gambling everything that Harden was secretly a superstar. The Oklahoman's lead Thunder reporter, Darnell Mayberry, was skeptical. "We'll see how that works out for Houston," he wrote. "My take is, it's a reach. Does anyone think Harden is capable of doing for Houston what Kevin freaking Durant does for OKC? How about what Russell Westbrook does? I never saw him possessing that ability, nor the desire to have that pressure on him. He was comfortable playing alongside two all-stars. It suited him and the Thunder perfectly. Now those days are long gone, and he might spend the rest of his career wishing he could have them back." Just 1 day after signing his questionable extension, Harden played his first game with his new team. All game, the ball was in his hands. There was no one to defer to. It was his first test. He played like an absolute superstar, shimmying through double teams, bulldozing defenders, scoring inside and out, making his mediocre teammates better, finishing with 37 points and 12 assists. It wasn't proof, of course, that the Thunder should have kept Harden, or that he was an actual, real-deal, long-term superstar, but it was quite an opening statement in the case. For one night, at least, Houston got a glimpse of the player it fantasized it had signed. "The Thunder's entire season," Mayberry wrote, "was about to become a referendum on Harden's trade to Houston." For OKC, that referendum began the following night in San Antonio. As an initial post-Harden test, the Spurs were perfect on many levels. It was the organization in which Sam Presti had gotten his start, and on which he had largely modeled the Thunder. It was also the team the Thunder had beaten the previous year to reach the finals, clawing their way back from an 0-2 deficit, using every drop of talent available in all three of their young stars. A trio that included Harden, of course, who had clinched the series with a three-pointer at the end of Game 6. How would the Thunder look now in his absence? Would the minor players be able to raise their games? Would Durant and Westbrook find a balance without their old third option? Would Westbrook be able to control himself? Back in Oklahoma City, Thunder fans sat clustered around screens, feeling fragile, turning these questions over in their minds, alert to any sign of trouble, sending their hopes and dreams out into the universe. "I hope for a win, but I don't expect it with the last-minute shakeup this weekend," wrote a commenter on OKC Talk. In the first minutes of the first quarter of the new season's first game, the collective sigh of relief emanating from the people of Oklahoma City might have been powerful enough to register on Gary England's screens. Every Thunder starter made his first shot of the year. Not only Westbrook and Durant, but Ibaka and Cephalosha, the deep cuts, the role players. The only one who didn't join the scoring party was Kendrick Perkins, the center, because he wasn't shooting at all, because that was the nature of Kendrick Perkins. After a summer of anticipation, after a week of agonized confusion, it was a perfect few minutes. Perhaps everything was actually going to be fine. The game's most interesting matchup was between the point guards, Russell Westbrook and Tony Parker. The ghost of Presti present versus the ghost of Presti past. In the early 2000s, when Presti discovered Parker in France, he had seen a player much like Westbrook was now. A gambler, fast and fearless and resilient. A small guy who made his name throwing himself recklessly into crowds of giants. Now, 13 years later, Parker was a Spurs legend, a three-time champion and finals MVP, and his game had mellowed to become logical and unfrantic. Every possession was a puzzle to be solved, patiently. He was a kind of anti-Westbrook. You could trust him to do the right thing in just about any situation. Parker looked at defenders when they tried to guard him with dismissive French ennui. Even his missed shots tended to be good misses. Westbrook, meanwhile, started the season Westbrooking as hard as he could possibly Westbrook. He kept asking the universe, why not? And the universe kept responding with an impressive variety of answers. Westbrook seemed determined to dominate Tony Parker, and Parker used that energy against him. Early in the game, Westbrook backed Parker down, spun wildly toward the hoop, threw the ball in a straight line clear past the rim, and then screamed at the referee about a theoretical foul. All while Parker pursed his lips and furrowed his brow, like someone trying to identify the precise terroir of a particularly tricky Bordeaux. Westbrook was pressing. He was always looking for fresh chips to put on his shoulders, and it seemed, perhaps, that this Harden situation was teetering up there now. He seemed to want his own first game to be an answer to Harden's, to prove to the world that the Thunder had kept the better player. In San Antonio, against the level-headed Tony Parker, it was not working. Westbrook was forcing shots and passes all over the court, and after its hot start, the Thunder's offense completely lost its flow. What Harden brought, steady control when the bigger stars didn't have it, was exactly what the team could have used. OKC shot a meager 37% for the game, and Westbrook was even worse than that, making only 6 of 21 shots. Despite all of this, however, the game remained close. Durant threw down long-armed, leaning dunks. Kevin Martin, Harden's replacement, flung in deep, opportunistic threes, doing his best impression of the absent man. With 3 minutes left, the Thunder trailed by only one. Westbrook dribbled up the court, surveyed the action, reared back, and flung a pass so wild it ricocheted off the bottom of the backboard, sending its apparent target, Kevin Durant, crashing to the floor. Somehow, in the ensuing chaos, Westbrook got the ball back, a precious extra possession so late in a close game, only to immediately force an off-balance jump shot between two defenders. He missed. 60 seconds later, Westbrook took a rash three-pointer off the dribble. He missed that too. Over the next minute, Westbrook managed to spin and fling his way to some free throws, which he made, giving the Thunder the lead. Then he drove for a short layup that would have put the Thunder up by 5, effectively sealing the game. But he missed it. And in the scramble that followed, he allowed Tony Parker to get free for a wide-open three-pointer, which Parker made. Tie game. Even by Westbrook's lofty standards, this had been a maddening sequence, a cascade of unforced errors, none of which was decisive on its own, but in the aggregate added up to just enough to give the Spurs a chance. The silver lining was that this was now a perfect test. OKC found itself tied with a great opponent in the final seconds. How would Durant and Westbrook find balance without Harden? Would one defer to the other, or would they work together? Who would control the control? Westbrook dribbled, surveying, and Durant came running out toward him, and Westbrook passed him the ball, and it did not go well. Either Durant was too slow, or the players weren't on the same page, because Durant's defender managed to reach out and tipped the pass, and Durant fumbled the catch, and the Spurs took it away. They called a timeout. Durant walked off the floor, hanging his head. Westbrook thrashed his arms in anger. Officially, the turnover was charged to Westbrook, his sixth of the game, against only five assists. But it could just as easily have been charged to the ghost of James Harden, or to Sam Presti's process, or to the bling-blorn Blarks, ancient symbol of life's ineluctable disharmony. Still, the game was not over. The players returned to the floor with the game tied, and less than 5 seconds left. At the whistle, Tony Parker made a looping run across the court, dodging through crowds, and Westbrook, who was supposed to be guarding him, got lost. He ended up standing for no good reason all the way under the rim, leaving Parker open 20 feet away, where he caught the ball, took one calm dribble, and, at the buzzer, swished the game-winning jump shot. The San Antonio crowd exploded, and the Spurs all clustered next to the scorer's table and leaped like giddy children. The Thunder went off to sit somberly in the locker room, where the mood was so low that even the reporters hesitated to break the silence. "Every few seconds," Mayberry wrote, with post-game lyricism, "a singular profanity would spring from around the corner, where running water rained down from the showers. It was all that pierced through the air." Thunder fans were less restrained. On comment boards, deep in the middle of the night, they began to panic. This was a terrible way to start the season. 0-1, winless without James Harden, on pace to lose all 82 games and become the worst team by far in the history of the NBA. The team's flaws had been exposed, and the people of OKC pecked at them ruthlessly with their keyboards. 11:08 p.m. "If Westbrook has the ball for more than 15 seconds in a possession, it will end in a turnover." 11:12 p.m. "The second team looked awful without Harden." 3:11 a.m. "Brooks is a horrible coach. Re-signing him will hurt this franchise more than letting Harden go in the long run." 4:34 a.m. "If Harden was still in town, Thunder win this game easily." 5:50 a.m. "Please, please, please, Russ. You are a year older. Playing under control 75% of the time not only is acceptable, but it's what elite players do." 7:09 a.m. "KD has to demand the ball at the end. Russ must get him the ball. This is absurdly frustrating." 8:33 a.m. "Wussle, oh Wussle, still pulling that same old wabbit out of the hat, I see. Same thing for KD, nonchalant as usual." 10:10 a.m. "Two chances to go up two possessions and one chance to have game-winning opportunity equal three bad RW decisions." 10:16 a.m. "I knew it. Fourth quarter of close games. You need James Harden, his calm, his playmaking, his scoring." But James Harden was busy elsewhere. In his second game with the Rockets, Harden was somehow even better than in the first. He made 14 of 19 shots and scored 45 points, a new career high. He was now averaging 41 points per game, first in the league by a very wide margin. It was a minuscule sample size, but for OKC, the data looked bad. James Harden, a player who had been coming off of the Thunder's bench 1 week earlier, was now looking like a superstar among the superstars. Eternal Present. One chilly Thursday on 15th Street, in the stately home of Mrs. I.R. McQueen, among the horse buggies and trolleys of the still-developing town, the Modern Classics Club met to listen to Lola Scott speak about literature, always a memorable event. The subject that day would have been of particular interest to the women of Oklahoma City: the mystery of time. They would be discussing the work of the English writer J.B. Priestley, whose philosophical plays were then all the rage in London. "Our conventional notions of time," Priestley posited, "were far too simplistic. The idea that we move through life shedding moments behind us like flower petals, one by one, as we stride off into the future. Instead," Priestley argued, "we live in an eternal now, in which the past has not vanished like a pricked bubble." Lola Scott read to the ladies from, among other works, Priestley's book, Midnight on the Desert. Our consciousness travels along this track as we might travel on a railway journey. Then the past is the station we have just left, and the future is the station we are approaching. The past has not been destroyed any more than the last station was destroyed when the train left it. Just as the station is still there, with its porters and ticket inspectors and bookstalls and its noise and bustle, so the past still exists, not as a dim memory, but in all its color and hum. Somewhere back along that fourth-dimensional track of the world, the dinosaurs are still roving. The Ice Age is melting. Men are building the pyramids and Babylon. Caesar is being assassinated. Shakespeare is just finishing Hamlet. And Lincoln is making his Gettysburg speech. Nothing, not a syllable, not the wink of an eyelash, has been lost. All its past is in existence along this track, not as a ghostly memory, a shadow show, but solidly real in its own eternal present. Priestley even raised the radical notion, mentioned to him once by a sea captain, that it might be possible for a number of people working together to change the past. In the years after stealing the Capitol, time would have been much on the minds of the citizens of Oklahoma City. The place had changed so much, so quickly. The prairie was disappearing rapidly at the edges of town. The old pioneer days were tipping hard toward an unknown future. Even prairie chickens were becoming increasingly scarce. In 1913, in order to capture some fragment of that disappearing world, the members of the Ladies' Aid Society decided to create a time capsule. They called it the Century Chest. Leading citizens of OKC paid a fee to enter objects and documents, newspapers, shoes, telephones, letters to the people of the future. The money would go toward buying a massive pipe organ for the First Lutheran Church. Angelo Scott, who was now in his mid-50s, was conscripted to write a brief message to the citizens of the 21st century. His voice, reading the message, was recorded on a wax cylinder, and this, too, was carefully cataloged and packed alongside all of the other items. On the 24th anniversary of the land run, amid much pomp and circumstance, the Century Chest was buried beneath the floor of the church on 13th Street, along with strict instructions to exhume and open it exactly 100 years later, on April 22, 2013. A date that must have seemed as unreal at the time as supersonic flight or pocket computers. 2 years later, in 1915, Angelo and Lola Scott settled into a home on 16th Street. This was on the absolute edge of the expanding city, at the northern border of the neighborhood of mansions, all of those gaudy monuments to OKC's new money. The Scott's house, by contrast, was spacious but understated. Angelo knew this area well from the days of the land run, 26 years before, when it had been the distant countryside, full of wildflowers, and he would ride out to escape the squabbling crowds of the city. Once, Scott wrote, he had gathered 26 varieties of flowers in less than as many minutes. From that distance, in those old days, the city would have been only a speck on the horizon. Now, however, there were houses all the way, including his and Lola's. 16th Street was an in-between place, city to the south, country to the north. And at night, with their windows open to catch Oklahoma's cooling breezes, the Scots would have heard cows mooing. During the day, in the muddy distance to the north, they would have seen the cows grazing around the construction site of the new Capitol building, which they would watch rising, slowly, over the course of several years, in the middle of absolutely nowhere. Even out there, however, developers were beginning to buy up land. Oklahoma City's nowheres were disappearing fast, and it was possible to imagine a day when they would actually be outnumbered by somewheres, people, structures, destinations, congregations. Someday, there would be no more countryside at all, no more cows, only houses, only city. Part 3. Color. It is always possible to bind quite large numbers of people together in love, provided that others are left out as targets for aggression. Sigmund Freud, Civilization and Its Discontents. This puts us in a somewhat paradoxical situation, in that we claim both that common knowledge is a prerequisite for agreement and coordinated action, and that it cannot be attained. Ronald Fagan, Reasoning About Knowledge. Good and evil, that's just people. J.B., Everything Was Beautiful and Nothing Hurt. Golden Grenade. 2 weeks into the 2012 NBA season, on an otherwise unassuming Saturday, Wayne Coyne shut down the Oklahoma City airport. It was an innocent mistake. You know how sometimes you accidentally leave a bottle of water in your carry-on bag, or some nail scissors, and airport security finds it and goes a little crazy? Well, Wayne Coyne had a grenade. Again, it was perfectly innocent. Wayne was on his way to Los Angeles to watch rehearsals of a musical based on Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, the Flaming Lips' gold-selling 2002 space epic quasi-concept album. And before that, he'd been up all night at a house party. And at some point in the swirl of the chaos, a fan had given Wayne this odd little art object, a real, metal, weapons-grade military grenade, heavy and deadly-looking, but painted all gold. Yes! A golden grenade! It was inactive, of course. There was a hole in the bottom. It was not a weapon. It was a metaphor. Peace and color and art are more powerful than war. Yes! Wayne had graciously accepted the gift. Yeah, because this was one of the bizarre constants in the great psychedelic journey that was the life of Wayne Coyne. People were always coming up to him, all over the world, and presenting him with unsolicited tokens of love, brotherhood, tribute. Books, figurines, clothing, truly awful oil paintings of the Flaming Lips on stage in which all of the band members' faces were out of proportion and weirdly bug-like. Wayne had learned that you just have to be nice and accept it, whatever it is. One time he tried to leave a painting in a cab because it was ugly and a total hassle to carry around, but the cabbie had made inquiries, tracked Wayne down, and the painting found its way back to him. The golden grenade, though, that was actually cool. So he took that happily. Yeah. Wayne liked things that were shiny and golden and weird. He liked explosions, video footage of mushroom clouds often flared up behind him on stage. So he threw the grenade into his duffel bag, where he throws all of the stranger's gifts that will fit, and then he totally forgot all about it and grabbed his bag and headed off to the airport to fly to L.A. The security crew at Will Rogers World Airport found Wayne Coyne's grenade for him. On the x-ray screen of Lane 2, amid the endless innocent drift of shoes and coins and laptops and jackets, an officer saw the unmistakable outline of a deadly explosive device. Alarms went off. The area was cleared. Certain non-negotiable emergency procedures were set into motion. A bomb expert was summoned. People trying to leave Oklahoma City were suddenly stuck in an unmoving line. Flights had to be rebooked. Wayne Coyne felt terrible. He stood there, next to the x-ray machine, in his rumpled suit, necktie hanging loose, shirt half unbuttoned, wild gray hair throbbing in bushy curls around his head, with glitter on his face and his fingernails painted in an electric spectrum of colors, and he explained to the men and women in uniform about the guy at the party, the duffel bag, the flaming lips, the terrible fan paintings. He was a good citizen. He had never, even once, in all his decades of international rock and roll shenanigans, been in any serious trouble with the law. The Flaming Lips were dues-paying members of the OKC Chamber of Commerce, for God's sake. There was a picture of Wayne and the band etched into the glass at this very airport, in its mural of famous Oklahomans. Grammy-winning alternative psychedelic rock, it said. And in that etching, Wayne was actually smiling and flashing a peace sign. The golden grenade, if you thought about it, was the opposite of terrorism. It was peace-erism. In the end, security was pretty cool about the whole thing. They believed Wayne that he wasn't trying to blow up the airport, and even the official police report painted him in a sympathetic light. Crime. Possessed bomb. Very cooperative and upfront. Said he should have known better. Still, once the bomb squad has been summoned, you can't just call everything off. There is a process. Even if the perpetrator happens to be the city's most famous goofball clown, a one-man glitter storm, a technicolor rock and roll Willy Wonka trying to make the whole world conform to his own private, epic, slow-mo, spirit journey, mushroom fantasy vision, even then, you can never be too careful. The only proper antidote to an explosion is time. Wayne Coyne was only being Wayne Coyne. He didn't mean any harm. But Wayne being Wayne intersected at a strange angle with the city of Oklahoma City being the city of Oklahoma City. The relationship between city and citizen was awkwardly charged. Wayne was famous enough that OKC basically had to claim him as a cultural asset, had to try to siphon out whatever quotient of hipness and glory it could from the association. It had to check its rock star box. But it was hardly a safe transaction. Wayne was famous in a slightly dangerous way. He was unpredictable to a degree that the conservative city did not like. This was a place whose newspaper published not only a daily prayer on its front page, but near-constant caricatures of an idiotic Barack Obama on its editorial page, and where a 6-foot-tall granite monument of the Ten Commandments would soon be erected next to the state capitol. Meanwhile, Wayne Coyne doused himself on stage with fake blood and reveled in public nudity. And sometimes he invited hundreds of fans to gather in parking garages without any kind of permit to play coordinated music from their car stereos. If you looked at Wayne's house on Google Maps, you would see him out in his front yard, apparently taking a bath. And so the city hesitated. Wayne Coyne was certainly around. City leaders appreciated that. But he was too full of some kind of unidentifiable, sloppy energy that Oklahoma City could not safely control. Any public embrace risked turning into a civic embarrassment. There had been attempts recently to achieve some tentative city-celebrity fusion. The most serious of these had come in 2007, almost exactly 5 years before the grenade incident, when OKC was right on the brink of seizing the Sonics from Seattle, and the fracking money was pouring in, and construction was booming, and the city was feeling strong and cocky and resurgent, and up for a calculated risk. On a cool, clear Thursday in October, the Oklahoma City government invited its citizens to attend an official ceremony, the dedication of Flaming Lips Alley. This was a bit of a joke, of course, an alley, not a street. It was a wink at the band's weirdness, an underground ethos. But it was also a hedge. It contained plausible deniability. Flaming Lips Alley stretched for 4 shabby blocks on the western edge of Bricktown, OKC's up-and-coming tourist district, a zone of formerly abandoned warehouses now occupied by chain restaurants and bars and one of the city's only Starbucks. The ceremony took place at the entrance to the minor league baseball stadium. A crowd of several hundred gathered near a bronze statue of Mickey Mantle, bat in hand, swinging his oaky heart out. Mantle was probably the most famous Oklahoman of all time, but his talent had been too big for the state, and so he had made his legendary career out in New York City, where he'd become a placeless everyman, winning 7 World Series and appearing on the cover of Time. Although Mantle had a statue in Oklahoma City, he belonged to all of America. Wayne Coyne belonged, uniquely, to Oklahoma City. In public, he liked to pretend that he was some kind of extraterrestrial, born out of one of Pink Floyd's tube amps, but this was only a pose. Wayne was as pure a product of Oklahoma City as the place had ever produced. His shaggy face should probably have been featured on the city seal. Wayne had come to OKC as a baby in the early 1960s, and unlike most of his creative peers, he never left. Even after the Flaming Lips hit it big in the early 1990s, after they signed with Warner Brothers and went into heavy rotation on MTV and appeared on an episode of Beverly Hills 90210 and won multiple Grammys and co-headlined Lollapalooza with Prince. Even at the height of all that, when the band was playing Buenos Aires and Tokyo and LA and Paris and Berlin and Melbourne and Toronto and New York, Wayne Coyne stayed. He bought a house in his childhood neighborhood, the unglamorous inner-city enclave known as Klassen 10-Pen, where dog packs roamed through weedy lots and drug deals went down behind the empty storefronts. And he hung out at dive bars and rode his bike all over the place and photocopied flyers at the local Kinko's. The Flaming Lips reclaimed pieces of OKC's blasted landscape and folded them into their art. They conducted sonic experiments in empty parking garages, made a film inside of an old gas station storage tank from a junkyard, and incorporated audio of one of their neighborhood dog packs into a song. Although the dedication of Flaming Lips Alley was an official city ceremony, Wayne and the band had been allowed to take the lead in designing it, so it looked like a miniature version of one of their concerts, somewhere on the aesthetic continuum between a North Korean state function and a low-budget educational puppet show about the dangers of LSD. Wayne warmed up the stage by playing a military camp song on a toy trumpet. The quick, peppy notes hopped out over the Bricktown streets. All around him, extras and costumes filled the stage. A crowd of beardless Santas. A cluster of green-headed Martians. An anthropomorphic yellow sun that bobbed back and forth, waggling its arms. Blizzards of confetti gushed in the wind. In front of all of this colorful nonsense stood a line of men in dark suits, official representatives of the city of Oklahoma City, looking like they had somehow been pranked. Eventually, one by one, the potentates stepped forward and spoke. "It sure is a lot cooler to have an alley than to have a street," the Oklahoma State Treasurer said, and he produced a huge gilded folder from which he read an official commendation of the Flaming Lips from the governor himself. "Oklahoma's history has been brightened through the gift of your work." "Now that's cool," said the vice chairman of the Bank of Oklahoma, and he proceeded to allow some words to spill out of his mouth on the subject of the Oklahoma City Chamber of Commerce. "Which I'm sure a lot of you think," he said, "are just a bunch of staid, old, gray-haired, hairy-legged guys that sit around thinking about how to beat up on young guys." He gave the crowd a moment to consider this image. "It's not true," he continued. "It's a very hip organization. It's committed to making this city the coolest city out there, and we've got a very hip and cool chairman president, Roy Williams." Roy Williams, black suit, red tie, fired a zany blast of steam out of some kind of transparent tube and walked to the microphone to unveil a gift from the chamber, a large novelty snow globe, tall as a human, featuring photos of the Flaming Lips superimposed over the uninspiring OKC skyline. The snow globe wobbled visibly, suggesting inferior craftsmanship. It was hard to imagine that any of these men had ever listened, on purpose, to a Flaming Lips album. Although the band's style was constantly changing, and although some of its songs were widely appealing, symphonic sing-alongs you might tap your foot to while waiting in line at Bricktown's Starbucks, the majority of the Flaming Lips catalog was noisy and experimental and almost painfully idiosyncratic. One album, Zyrica, was designed to be listened to on four CDs simultaneously via four different sound systems and featured song titles such as "The Big Old Bug is the New Baby Now" and "March of the Rotten Vegetables." The businessmen on stage probably didn't know the band's music well enough to know how thoroughly they would have disliked it. Nevertheless, there was an alley to dedicate. Suit after suit strode to the microphone, and the aliens cheered, and confetti rained down, and a huge gray caterpillar with crazy eyes and rosy cheeks and a golden crown went skittering around through the crowd. And eventually, Mayor Mick Cornett thrust the new street sign over his head like he had just won WrestleMania and shouted, triumphantly, "Flaming Lips Alley!" Wayne Coyne shimmered to the front of the stage. He wore a roughly pink dress shirt under a pinstriped suit, bow tie hanging loose under the scraggle of his short beard. He was, at that time, 46 years old, and his hair was just beginning to gray at the temples, with a stylish white streak in the front. He looked raffish and teasing and naughty, like he was on his way home at the end of a night of wild excess. "He looks like a best man," a YouTube commenter would later put it, "the morning after a wedding, where he randomly worked his way through all the bridesmaids." But this was the funny thing about Wayne, and one of the reasons he was acceptable, barely, to the city's corporate sponsors. Despite his wild appearance, Wayne was as stable, in his way, as any of these gray-haired businessmen. He famously did not do drugs, and he worked like a dog on his music, and he had somehow managed to sustain one monogamous relationship for 20 years with an equally eccentric artist named Michelle. And of course, most important, Wayne Coyne had committed himself to Oklahoma City. This was the thing he shared, above all, with the other men on stage. Through OKC's bad decades, through its many busts and failures, none of them had abandoned the place, as so many others had, for Dallas, or Austin, or New York, or Los Angeles. Every local newspaper article about Wayne ended with some version of this statement. With his wife, Michelle, Coyne still lives in the neighborhood where he grew up. It was the kind of press any chamber of commerce would love. Wayne hugged the Flaming Lips Alley sign to his chest with both arms, like a favorite niece, and began to speak to the crowd. As this alley has sort of been christened this week, he said, everybody has sort of asked me, Wayne, why do you think, it took so long, for Oklahoma City, to recognize you? This was odd. Wayne was normally an effortless speaker in every context imaginable, whether talking to a late-night TV host or a journalist in his car or an ecstatic arena of 30,000 fans. He could go on for hours about anything until his interlocutors begged him for mercy. And yet now he seemed overwhelmed, emotional, almost on the brink of tears. What was wrong with him? Any normal Beelzebub-fearing rock star would have regarded this goofy civic honor as laughably square. And certainly a rock star like Wayne, who would sell his fans gummy fetuses and inject the blood of collaborators into the vinyl of his albums. But here in Bricktown, Wayne was floundering. This ceremony was somehow touching him deeply. The Chamber of Commerce had nicked a powerful force at Wayne Coyne's core. It took him a full minute on stage before he burst out with something identifiably Wayne-like. "It's pretty fucking cool," he finally said, "to have an alley named after you." The crowd roared, and at Wayne's side, Mayor Cornett grimaced at the expletive, then hung his head and covered his face with both hands, rubbing his eyes. It was a devil's bargain, this transaction. It was like hiring an actual pirate to perform at your child's birthday party. But it was too late for the city to back away. Flaming Lips Alley existed. Wayne and his kooky band had been legally inscribed into the infrastructure of Oklahoma City, added to the official maps alongside all the other historic men and women, but mostly men, who had helped to make the city almost sort of great in its way. If you started at Flaming Lips Alley, you could traverse the whole heart of downtown on nothing but famous names. Mickey Mantle Drive, Johnny Bench Drive, E.K. Gaylord Boulevard, Robert S. Kerr Avenue, Couch Drive. Baseball stars, a media mogul, an oil baron and political powerhouse, and the boomer mayor who died for his land. Any artist in the world, Wayne told the crowd, picking up steam, if they felt somehow disheartened or discouraged or wondered if anybody ever cared out there in the world, I'd say, well, come to Oklahoma City and walk down Flaming Lips Alley. And even though it has dumpsters and maybe some trucks unloading some beer in the back, I think it would really encourage them to know that we never demanded anybody give us anything, but little by little, it was the people of Oklahoma City that believed in us, and even the people in the city government. Here, it struck me, was the emotion roiling Wayne Coyne. He loved Oklahoma City. He actually loved it. OKC was not a major city by any stretch, but it was exactly the right place to grow a Wayne. The city's wasted landscape was full of cracks, and those cracks were full of soil, and that soil contained precisely the right nutrients to nurture whatever outlandish microspecies of weed flower Wayne was. A spiky sort of kudzu vine with Venus flytrap heads, its tendrils eager to climb any structure that happened to be nearby, regardless of how rusty or uninspiring. No one had any idea what to do with this plant, but it was oddly fun to look at, even if it sometimes scattered stinky, oozy seed pods all over people's sidewalks and yards. Besides, it didn't matter if you liked it or not, because it was impossible to uproot. One more time, standing next to the mayor, Wayne Coyne swore on the municipal stage. "We're on our way to becoming, I think, the fucking coolest city in America," he said. And this time the crowd lost it completely, and Mayor Cornett's face remained frozen in an official smile until he and Wayne, a short time later, went off to cut a red ribbon together with matching golden shears. In retrospect, that awkward civic ceremony was the high point in the strained marriage of Wayne Coyne and the city of Oklahoma City. The years that followed brought a string of public embarrassments, major and minor. In 2011, it was the absolute boondoggle of the womb when Wayne and the Flaming Lips rented a large brick building downtown and, without asking the landlord or getting any of the necessary permits, had it painted overnight with explosive colors, complete with garish murals of robots shooting lasers and marijuana leaves stenciled on the sidewalk outside. The building's front door looked like a giant, abstract vagina. Wayne announced that it was going to be an art gallery called The Womb, inside of which would be an even larger, more realistic vagina for visitors to walk through. He told the local news that the gallery would be inaugurated with a fantastical New Year's party, to which the entire world was invited, and at which teenagers might be able to drop acid with Yoko Ono. But this party, sadly, would never occur. Shortly after Wayne's announcement, the fire marshal showed up at the womb, and he moved stoically through the building, pointing out code violations everywhere. The giant vagina, it was determined, did not provide sufficient egress for a crowd of more than 50 people. A red sticker was affixed to the womb's front door. All work operations stopped. There were further incidents. A citizen poll chose the Flaming Lips song, Do You Realize, as the official state rock song of Oklahoma, but the state's conservative House of Representatives refused to approve it after the band's bassist, Michael Ivins, came to the Capitol wearing a t-shirt featuring a hammer and sickle. Another legislator cited, with disapproval, Wayne's cursing at the Flaming Lips Alley ceremony years before. Their lips ought to be on fire, he said. In the summer of 2012, as the womb still languished in limbo, Wayne Coyne suffered a personal trauma. He and Michelle, the bohemian power couple of the Great Plains, suddenly divorced, a gossipy scandal that was much whispered and blogged about in OKC and beyond. Wayne's stable life began to destabilize. After decades of principled abstinence, he started to use recreational drugs, MDMA, mushrooms, cocaine. On Twitter, he posted a picture of huge powdery lines on a mirror next to a rolled-up dollar bill. He managed to get himself kicked off of Instagram twice for violating the site's nudity policy. He got into a feud somehow with Erykah Badu. Meanwhile, the Flaming Lips were in a dry spell of real commercial success. Their best-known single, the silly alt-rock anthem, She Don't Use Jelly, was by then nearly 20 years old. And their critically revered album, The Soft Bulletin, was 13. Recent reviews had been mixed. Wayne's singing voice, a reedy, awkward, scraping thing on its very best day, was beginning to lose its upper range. It was in the midst of all these problems that Wayne brought his grenade to the OKC airport. The incident became international news. It was picked up by The Guardian, Rolling Stone, The Huffington Post. Wayne coined grenade debacle. CBS, notoriously eccentric, Spin, reputation for unusual behavior, and numerous online gossip sites. TMZ, he pulled the nade stunt because he and his lame band are currently residing in the Where Are They Now file. Twitter users addressed Wayne directly. I'm less bothered by your airport grenade than I am about the fact that you are 51 and dress like a crazy asshole every day. In Oklahoma City, the incident rattled its way through the court of public opinion. At a Thunder game one day, a local sports writer said to me, rather bluntly, "That guy is such a douche, bringing a grenade into the airport on purpose just to get attention. It's pathetic." The Lost Ogle, the same blog that spent much of its bandwidth mythologizing the godlike powers of Gary England, seized upon the Golden Grenade incident to unleash a brutal referendum on late-phase Wayne Coyne. The site interviewed a furious traveler who'd been forced to pay $1,000 to rebook a flight, and it accused Wayne of degenerating from a fun-loving, goofy, creative genius who writes and performs psychedelic pop songs into a sex-obsessed, creepy old man who hunts down 21-year-old groupies in the OKC bar scene. In the city that had so recently honored him, the legend of Wayne Coyne was beginning to curdle. And yet, Wayne remained. This was his way. Oklahoma City could abandon him completely, could mock him at every turn, tear down the Flaming Lips alley signs, flee the city en masse, allow the skyscrapers to collapse and the landscape to revert to prairie, and Wayne would not leave. He would cobble together a life, alone, out of the OKC rubble. He would pour his essence into the empty alleys and streets and parking garages and dumps and underpasses and warehouses, adapting them all to his own inscrutable ends. Wayne Coyne was Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma City was Wayne Coyne, and it would be that way until the very end, when he would die and be absorbed into the place completely, merging with it eternally. Game 7. Mr. Oklahoma City. After the Thunder's unfortunate opening night in San Antonio, when Russell Westbrook managed to wildcat a win into a last-second loss, the team began to recover. Over the next week, Oklahoma City beat Portland and Toronto and Chicago, winning by margins that no amount of why not could ruin. Still, the vibe on the court was strange. The players seemed to be haunted by their hardenlessness. Everyone was acting weird. Serge Ibaka, the shot-blocking power forward, had begun to experiment unsuccessfully with shooting threes. Westbrook was as erratic and individualistic as ever, shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting, despite making a frankly offensive 37% of his shots. Even Kevin Durant, human metronome of basketball excellence, was a little off. He seemed to be trying to compensate for Westbrook's excess shooting by hardly shooting at all. Instead, Durant was attempting to transform himself, against the natural order of things, into a passer. But he was not a passer. He was a scorer. Durant had been the reigning NBA scoring champion since the unprecedented age of 21, and now he was 24, and all signs pointed to him leading the league in scoring until he was 31, or 41, or however long he felt like it. In the opening week of the season, however, Durant was inexplicably forcing passes all over the court, and he was turning the ball over at an alarming rate. He had twice as many turnovers as even Russell Westbrook, the NBA's poster boy for the reckless squandering of possessions. Still, somehow, the Thunder were winning. Even at its non-best, Oklahoma City had enough talent to vanquish the rival cities of North America. Destiny, sometimes, will agree to look the other way until the details match up with its grand plan. During this opening stretch, if you happen to look down toward the end of the team's bench, very far down, past Westbrook and Durant and all of the role players, then past all of those players' backups, and then even farther than that, past everyone, in fact, who was wearing a Thunder uniform, you might have noticed, eventually, a very large man dressed in a very large suit. This was Daniel Orton. He was hard to miss. At nearly 7 feet tall and more than 250 pounds, Orton was, even by NBA standards, unusually big and wide. And yet he sat at the end of the bench with a gentle, expressionless face, watching the game, saying nothing. Orton was the Thunder's backup center, trapped in the depth chart, behind both the offensively challenged Kendrick Perkins and the omni-challenged Hashim Thabeet. Although he was a marginal player, Orton represented something that neither of the other two centers ever could. He brought something to the team, in fact, that not even Durant or Westbrook could bring on their best days. Daniel Orton had a superpower. On the whole roster, in the whole history of the Thunder franchise, he was the only player who was actually from Oklahoma City. Orton grew up among cul-de-sacs and strip malls in a neighborhood north of OKC's downtown core. In high school, he won 3 consecutive state championships and turned himself into a 5-star national recruit. In college, he was a member of the legendary 2010 University of Kentucky team that started the season 19-0 and finished 35-3, and saw 5 of its players, including Orton, picked in the first round of the NBA draft. Orton, however, did not immediately flourish as a pro. He was drafted by Orlando, where he had to sit behind the mighty Dwight Howard. And before he could find a way to earn himself any playing time, he blew out his knee. And eventually, after 2 seasons of rehab and disappointment, the Magic released him. An ignominious fate for a first-round pick. But then Orton's hometown came calling. That summer, in search of another credible big man, the Thunder invited Daniel Orton to training camp. He was still only 22, still potentially a real player in the league. During scrimmages, Orton watched the drama boiling among Durant and Westbrook and Harden. And in the midst of all that, he was able to show off his own game. Real power, good hands, a soft touch, and flamboyant passing skills for a big man. It was all impressive. Durant later told people, privately, that he thought Orton was the best center on the roster. But apparently to the coaches, it was not quite impressive enough. At the end of training camp, on the Saturday morning before the season began, Orton was the last man cut from the team. He and his agent started to talk, very seriously, about a career in China. Later that night, Orton's phone lit up, like everyone else's, with the news that Sam Presti had traded James Harden. People were shocked, but Orton was not. He had sensed it coming. Then Orton's phone lit up again, and this time it was a shock. Presti wanted him back. The Harden trade had sent out more players than it brought in, which meant that the Thunder suddenly needed to fill a roster spot. Less than 24 hours after he'd been cut, Orton was back on the team. Just like that, he went from being jobless and desperate to having a guaranteed spot at a salary of nearly $1 million with the defending Western Conference champions of the entire NBA, who also happened to play in his hometown. Orton was roughly the same age as Westbrook and Durant, and yet his career had been so derailed by injuries and lack of opportunity that hardly anyone, even in OKC, knew who he was. In terms of celebrity, he was a perfect counterbalance to his superstar teammates. In San Antonio, on opening night, Orton sat in his suit on the end of the bench and watched, stoically, anonymously, as Westbrook turned the ball over and allowed Tony Parker to hit the game-winning shot. Orton didn't play the next night either, in the team's home opener, when Westbrook removed his feet from James Harden's empty locker room chair long enough to score 32 points in a blowout win over the Trailblazers. 2 days later, during a bad home loss to a weak Atlanta Hawks team, Orton watched Westbrook and Thabo Sefolosha bicker so insistently that they had to be separated. He sat on the bench during the Thunder's fourth game, watching as Hashim Thabeet burst out into the open court with a steal on his way toward a highlight dunk, only to trip spectacularly over his own legs and go crashing to the floor. While some of the players on the Thunder bench stood to give Thabeet a laughing ovation, Orton just sat there, watching. This is what Orton did. He sat and watched. He didn't perform sideline theatrics, as most NBA bench players did. Didn't dance after highlight dunks or launch into elaborate high-five routines. Friends told him that he looked bored during games, that he should try to be more enthusiastic. But that just wasn't him. He struggled to stay focused when he wasn't involved. Even in the locker room, he was quiet. Orton would always gather his things and sneak out before the media was allowed in. He hated the awkwardness of those locker room interactions, reporters milling around while everyone got dressed, trying to work up the courage to ask players questions. So he vanished. Orton was the Thunder's invisible man. Even when Orton did manage to get recognized in public, it wasn't as himself. This was one of the great ironies of his return to Oklahoma City. Everyone on the street thought that he was Russell Westbrook. Their faces looked uncannily alike, and so everywhere Orton went, restaurants, gas stations, grocery stores, people would whisper and point and reach for their phones. After a while, Orton gave up on correcting them. He would just nod, smile for the photo, and move on. It was the worst of both worlds, a nondescript career attached to the face of a celebrity. He had been existentially displaced in his own hometown. On November 11th, the day after Wayne Coyne tried to board a plane with his golden grenade, Daniel Orton's opportunity finally came. It was the seventh game of the season. The Cleveland Cavaliers were in town. Thabeet was out with a sprained ankle, so Orton was put on the active list, which meant, if nothing else, that he actually got to wear his uniform while sitting on the bench. November 11th also happened to be a fateful date in the history of OKC, the anniversary of the resignation, in 1889, of William Couch, the city's first mayor, when he left office to defend his contested land outside of town, a decision that set him in motion toward his doom. Somehow, no acknowledgement of this fact was made over the arena's PA system. Orton sat and watched as the game turned into a blowout. Finally, with 2 minutes and 2 seconds left, Scott Brooks called his name. Orton shed his warm-ups, ambled over to the scorer's table, and checked in. It was only garbage time, but it was basketball, and Orton played well, considering. Even in the NBA, his body took up an impressive amount of space on the floor. He defended the post stubbornly and rebounded with strength. With 20 seconds left in the game, Orton had a moment. He leaped out on defense and got his fingertips on an opponent's three-point shot, blocking it, and then he raced to the other end, caught a pass on the run, and finished a fast-break layup. 2 points. In the grand scheme of things, this meant nothing. But it was the first time Daniel Orton had put a ball through the hoop during an official game in Oklahoma City since the glory days of high school. It was, perhaps, the beginning of the new beginning. One day, at the end of a practice, I sat down with Daniel Orton to ask him about his fairy tale return to his hometown, this sudden opportunity to win a championship in front of all of his family and friends. Orton, in my mind, had become the human embodiment of the OKC Renaissance, a living link between the people and the team. If everything broke properly, his personal story would be the perfect ending to the larger story of the Thunder. The native son, standing shoulder to shoulder with the stars, bringing long-deserved glory to his humble hometown. Maybe Orton's presence on the team could even help heal the wound left by the absence of Harden. I asked Orton if he felt this way. He did not. Not at all. "It doesn't really matter to me," he said in a flat voice. "I mean, it's basketball. Anywhere is basketball. As long as you get to play. Any type of court I'm on, I'm home. I don't really think about it. Not really. Not really." I was, for a moment, genuinely shocked. For months, I had been steeped in the triumphant narrative of the Oklahoma City Thunder, a fable of pure, selfless solidarity in which everything got infinitely better at all times. Orton, however, expressed a deep alienation from the city and a wariness toward the Thunder organization that I had yet to hear from anyone else. His more famous teammates, young men from Los Angeles, D.C., Switzerland, and the Congo, seemed more attached to OKC and more permanently settled there than Orton did. Place and identity had slipped out of alignment. In fact, Orton told me that he had come to think of Orlando as his true home. That's where he'd been drafted, he said, where he had a house, where his girlfriend lived. In the months that followed, I came to appreciate this about Orton. He was bluntly honest, sometimes to the point of comedy. Unlike Durant, he didn't slip into telling you what he knew you wanted to hear. Unlike Westbrook, he didn't defiantly shut you down. He just politely said what he thought, at all times. It would have been easy for Orton to play up his connection to Oklahoma City. Easier, in many ways, than telling the uninspiring truth. But he never did. If Orton was, indeed, some kind of living embodiment of the place, as I had prematurely decided, it was not the Chamber of Commerce's version of the city, the booster brochure that was beginning to appear in national magazine stories, a community surfing to collective glory on basketball and big energy and visionary citizen-funded infrastructure programs. Orton represented a different place entirely. He was young, but he had already seen plenty of difficulty, both personal and civic, and he was willing to talk about it. How his mother had died of lupus when he was still a teenager. How he had struggled during his single year of college. How his knees had ruined his rookie season. How he had become estranged from his father. Orton still believed that he would become an NBA star someday, but he knew that the story would not be simple. It was too late for that. He was never going to have anything like the relationship his teammates had with OKC. They had all arrived as heroes. Orton had arrived as a baby. If he stood for anything at all, It was not the fantasy of Oklahoma City, but the thing itself. The plain old muddy expanse that had once been at the bottom of an ocean. The world of spectacular dreams brought back down to earth. There were dark strains to the place, past and present. Complexities, tensions, uneasinesses, outbreaks of violence,